Do you want a beautiful lawn? Enter True Green, the easiest way to get a great lawn. Just water and mow, and they'll do the rest. Weed control, fertilization, aeration, and more. True Green is the official lawn care treatment provider of the PGA Tour, and they have a verified best price, which guarantees you the lowest price with no compromise on quality. You do you. Let True Green do your lawn care. Visit truegreen.com, TRUGREEN.com, to get the best lawn at the best price with the best people. Guaranteed.
Welcome to another episode of LaCart on Location. I'm your host, Steve LaCart. And folks, you spent more than 20 years of your life traveling the road, first as a crew chief in NASCAR and now as an analyst for NBC. You are bound to meet some interesting characters along the way. With LaCart on Location, the goal is to bring you closer to some of these personalities I've met. And normally, we would do it in a great location, but this is 2020, so the location is my office. And my guest location, by the look of this Zoom video, is his home. So today, joining me on the podcast is NASCAR race car driver Corey LaJoy. Corey, bud, thanks for joining me, man.
I appreciate it, Steve. Thanks for having me. I wish we could do it on location because I don't know if you're like anything like me. I'm about fed up with all these Zoom meetings we got over the last couple months.
I mean, I'm telling you, like when Zoom first started, I said, this is cool. I can see people. And now everybody wants to Zoom. And I'm like, man, I'd like that conference call. I can just put my earbuds in and kind of go about my day anymore. And I am ready to kind of get out and see the world again. It was nice to see racing's back and with some fans, which is always fun. We just come off a race up in New Hampshire. There were some fans in the stands. As a driver, and we're going to get into a lot of other things, but you mentioned this crazy time. As a driver in the car with the engine, do you still feel the energy when there's fans in the stands?
I'll be honest. When you put the helmet on and you fire it up, from that point in time until the checkered flag, you don't really notice a whole lot of fans not being there. Places like Daytona, Bristol, especially at the night race when all the flash bulbs are going off, that's when the couple events a year where you notice things. Sorry if you hear.
Oh, no, I love it. Well, we're getting to that. If you're hearing the crying in the background, we're going to discuss this because Corey's a new dad this year. I got a long list. I've done my research. I got my notebook here. So No apologies at all. Welcome to dadhood.
Dude, it's a lot of work. Unexpected things. They don't send you from the hospital with a blueprint or owner's manual when you bring that kid back to the house. But it's been a lot of fun to learn a lot of different things that you wouldn't expect to learn. But my wife's been crushing it. And what a time to bring a kid into the world, right? He literally came the Wednesday before Atlanta. So he came 2 days later. I was en route. I was actually passing James Finch's Phoenix Racing shop, or what was Harry Scott's shop on the left right there in Spartanburg, when I got the call that everything was canceled. So I was able to turn back around and all that. So it was actually kind of a paternal leave of sorts with 2-3 months of not having any race and to hang out with the wife and little Levi. It's been a lot of fun.
That's awesome. Don't take notes from me because I have 2 children and I've changed about 5 diapers. So my wife will say why I've been a good provider and I'm a real good father to teenagers. I am not good with newborns. I'm not the man. You don't want to follow my manual.
I can understand that. I thought I was going to be like that as well. But, you know, I've actually been getting in. And I take the morning shifts usually from, 6:45, 7 o'clock, and the first bottle is usually when he lets a good one go. So it, I don't know what it is. I don't know if it stinks a little bit less when it's your own kid or it stinks and you just don't care. But I'm not scared to change a baby's diaper. Not as much as I was before it came.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Well, while we are on the topic of family, it's a great transition. So a third generation racer. So I pick on this because I'm a New England kid. You're a New England racer who was never born in New England. I always get that. People think, I'm like, oh, no, he's from – well, no, actually, he was born in North Carolina. But third year, your grandfather, Don, racer in Connecticut. Your dad, Randy, very well known, did TV, did a stint in the race car, has a seat business now, a 2-time Xfinity Series champion. You, though, are a Southern-born kid, North Carolina-born. I guess my question is, for me, I think I always dreamt of working in racing. I never dreamt of being a driver. My dad's not a driver. He built cars. So I always loved the car aspect.
as a third generation racer, did you ever have a chance not to be a race car driver?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely had a chance not to be. I think everybody, no matter if you make it, whether you came from a racing background or not, there was always a watershed moment where you had to choose to be a race car driver or you choose to not pursue that path, especially to get to the professional level. And when I was a kid, you know, my dad just naturally stuck me on a go-kart when I was four. That's just what you do when you're in a family. You jump in a go-kart and you go. But you know, he never pushed me towards racing. It was always, I had to work on the cars and get them ready. I had to load the cars up, right, to do the whole bit. And I played baseball through middle school and high school, and I was fairly decent at that. Had a lot of fun playing it. But junior in high school was like the fork in the road moment. There was a couple things that transpired where, you know, I wasn't putting effort into maintaining the cars like I was supposed to, and also working with trainers and being in a batting cage and doing all this stuff. So I was, both were hindering. So I had to pick one or the other. And, you know, when I looked ahead 10 years down the road, I much rather would be a race car driver than be a baseball player. And some weeks I question that decision, but most of the weeks I think I made the right choice.
You know, when I look at your progression, everything makes sense and it's clear. And then it gets a little foggy, right? Go-karts to Bandoleros, won in Bandoleros, moved up to Legends, won in Legends, won in Late Models, won in K&N. And then I lose track. And this is the conversation that, so as an analyst, I'm a little ashamed. I'm like, I should know this. Like, I cover this guy on the track. I want to know how he got here. But, you know, there was the NASCAR Next program. There was the RPM development draft. Take me through that bridge from K&N winner to Cup Series regular, right? How did that bridge connect?
It's a good question. Because there was a couple years or so in the middle there where the trajectory looked like this, and then it just, there was a cliff that pretty much dropped to the bottom. So what happened was we were doing our own K&N deal, had some success. We ran toe-to-toe with Kyle Larson. We lost the championship by 6 points. That was a year with guys like Brett Moffitt, Chase Elliott, Daniel Suarez, Bubba, Matt DiBenedetto.
Pretty good list.
It was a pretty stacked year there in K&N. And, you know, it was me and a buddy from high school that were working on our cars going to the racetrack. You know, you saw it firsthand. Lance McGrew was working on Chase's stuff. So, like, they had all these – Bill Wilburn and all these guys. Like, those were the guys we were racing against, me and my 17-year-old buddy Steve-O at the time. And we, you know, we had some good help along the way to help us, but, so we had some success there. From there we went, and I signed that RPM development deal, which was, you know, it looked great from the start. You know, you sign a contract when you're a little kid, you want to drive for Richard Petty, right? Like,
yeah,
that everybody's dream. So, you know, there was, just like everybody else, that the struggle was trying to get sponsorship to progress into Xfinity. But they helped me out with the ARCA cars. And then, you know, we ran, I think, four or five ARCA races. We won all but one, I believe, or two. So, hang on. The Formula machine is going off.
I like this. I like, you know what? This is real. Till you talk about, listen, yeah. So I'm talking to Corey LaJoie, Cup Series driver. It's Letard on location. And the location, normally we pick a great place. You hear like a bar in the background or beer bottles or whatever. Well, in 2020, I'm in my office. He's a new father at home. So we had a crying baby. Now we have the Formula machine. This is real life. I'm digging this.
Yeah, this is real life. This is reality now. It's
I like this.
And not a whole lot of things that Corey or Kelly likes to do so much anymore. You're tied to the hip to a little four-month-old that needs to sleep and cry and eat. But it's an awesome chapter of life to be in for sure. But so we were still back to RPM. You know, I built a lot of great relationships that I still have today with, you know, RP and Dale Inman and Brian Moffitt, who runs the team, Andy Murstein, the owner as well, who's been in the news last couple of days with the Bubba Wallace free agency stuff they're trying to work out. But you know, so we worked hard to try to cultivate sponsors. There was some stuff that happened with their Xfinity program with a kid came in and essentially bought the ride, not from underneath of me, but he had what they needed to make the ends meet, and they took it and they rolled with it. And then there was more or less it kind of dissolved. Right. I was trying to figure out some different things to drive. I was getting hit or miss opportunities. And when I was jumping in opportunities, I was overdriving or trying too hard or going to places I've never been before. And, you know, not doing a very good job, not doing what I was expected to do, or I guess what I expected myself to do, because I hold myself to as high standards as anybody else could. You know, and all the driving opportunities dried up more or less. So to pay the bills, I went back to crew chiefing, which I never really did that officially until I had to start getting paid for it. So I started flying out west to crew chief for David Mayhew for a season. So that, I had a lot of fun with that. David's an awesome driver. Steve McGowan, who owns that team, Roundy, he treated me really well and helped out with the super late model down the road. But we went and we won Sonoma. We won a couple other short track races, and that was kind of the path I was on, just because I had no options to drive. Not that I gave up that dream, because I felt like I was capable enough to do it in the right opportunities with the right people, but just the chapter in my life at that point in time was to be in crew chief. So I think that was that 2014 or 15, I did that. And then a company who I met when I was at RPM, U Theory, they followed my social media, and we kept in touch for 16 months or so to 2 years. And they had some marketing budget, and they wanted to help me out and get back into racing in the driving side. So I met with them, took that sponsorship money to a team in the Xfinity Series called JGL. Went to 10 races, 12 races, 15 races, had some success, started building relationships again. And then Ron Devine needed a driver for that 83 Unchartered Cup car. And he strapped me in the Daytona 500 qualifying race, the 125. We were not locked in. We had to race our way in. And I had zero drafting experience at that point in my life. Practice actually rained out. So my first practice experience.
No, nothing. Just go get the biggest race of the year. Should be fine. Don't worry.
My owner, Ron, he was the one who's physically putting the window net up. He goes, all right, big man, you know, if you get this thing in the show, we probably can race a couple more times. If not, you know, we'll probably end up shutting this team down. And then he put the window net up. I'm like, all right, here we go. Tighten the belts. And, you know, the one thing led to another. You know, I put my car in a position I probably shouldn't have been, looking back at it, but with Reed Sorensen, he was the guy who I was racing with. And the moral of the story is I got in the 500, and I think I raced 31 or 20, 32 times with Ron, and learned a lot of the things, what not to do in the Cup Series. It's a hard learning curve to try to adjust to, especially with limited Xfinity starts. And I've really just been lucky along the way to figure out how to swim. And it's not even a deep end of the pool, I try to explain to people. It's like jumping off a helicopter into the middle of the ocean and trying to figure out where land is and try to swim at the same time. So it's I've had a lot of trials by fire, but I think ultimately it's what's going to pay off here in the long run.
I'm officially stealing that. I like that, because I keep calling it the deep end of the pool, and it's not a big enough step.
I said being that it's the deep end of the pool infers that there's a shallow end that you could swim to get to.
And there's nothing.
There's no shallow end you can swim to. You're just figuring out how to tread water.
I see it. Up in the analysts, you know, I get to be up in the booth and watch these races, and forget the front four, right? Front five where the races are won. Like, that's spectacular to see guys that, like, the best at their craft making moves to try to win the race. But from like 9th to 30th, it is like a drunken bar fight. You know, it's like if you're not swinging, then you're getting hit. And you don't know where the next punch is coming from.
1,000% correct. Yeah. I mean, and unfortunately, a lot of the best storylines are the ones that are racing for the win. Naturally, it's racing. You try to race. But, you know, those races for 18th sometimes are just as exciting, if not more, than what the leaders are trying to position themselves, doing track position, or whatever the case may be. But the race for 18th might be the race for the lucky dog. And that might be the difference between how your day goes start to finish. And a lot of the times it's not covered unless you're physically at the track and you get to spectate it for yourself.
I tell the producers all the time, it's like the guy that makes the putt on the 17th hole on a Friday to make the cut. Nobody knows it happened, and it could have changed this guy's life, right? Makes one cut, gets his card, makes 10 more. Like there's these moments in time that sometimes we're not, you know, intelligent enough to know this is a moment, like that lap in the Daytona qualifying race for you, right? I look back on these calls I made to lose races or to win races, and I'm like, was that the fork in the road? I didn't even know it was the fork, and I was standing there and didn't know what direction to take. So, you know, you kind of got us way to Cup, 17 part-time, 18 part-time. I bring up 19 because you might – something about you has always gravitated to the marketing side. And when you rolled into Daytona with Old Spice on the car and your big grill on the hood, your big face on the hood, like – that is a memorable moment for nothing to do with competition. Tell me what that was like. Did you expect this to blow up? Would you expect it to be quite as talked about as it was?
Well, it wasn't my idea. I can't take credit for it.
It was a good idea.
It was a good idea. It was all actually it was Old Spice's team there was no option like A, B, or C. Like, this is what we're doing.
Yeah, right. No, we're paying and we're putting your face on the hood.
Yeah, like, you know, we're trying to pitch our new line of male shampoo or men's dry shampoo, and we want to make a quote-unquote memeable moment. And that was as memeable as a race car can get, with my face on the hood, with the mouth and the grill and the whole and the hair going back and the whole bit. Now, it has turned into be one of the probably the most memorable moments in my career to date. Hopefully I can put some competitive moments
People
can buy, but for now we've been able to do a lot of cool things with the partners that we've had through Go Fast with Old Spice, Schluter and Corvette Parts with the Scooby-Doo scheme last year was really cool, and even this year with Corvette Parts did the face scheme with the N95 mask on the front, so that was pretty creative and have a lot of fun with that. And we're trying to turn it around on track too. We've had a couple good runs, trying to keep building on top of that.
Yeah, I've been impressed with your performance on track. You mentioned your partners. You have some great partners. There's another weekend, though, that I don't think gets talked about enough. I was proud to be a very, very, very small part of it, but it was Watkins Glen a year ago. And I need to know some of the backstory. So the what I know about it, right, is there's this program, SamaritansFeet.org. They're on your race car at Watkins Glen. And you, I don't think – maybe you knew how many names it was going to be, but you raise your hand and say, if you sponsor this thing, if you spend a donation, you're going to personally write everyone's name on that race car. And to the fans listening, I came down to the garage at Watkins Glen. I'm like, all right, let me see it. It's here somewhere. Well, sure enough, I was shown. There's my name written on the race car. Ended up raising well over $200,000. Make sure that's accurate. I mean, it was a ton of money for a great cause. Yeah. So first of all, before you even get into the great cause, SamaritansFeet.org, explain what it is.
Yeah, so it's actually a Charlotte-based charity. So my wife and I went to a missions trip 3 years ago now, and when you're down in Haiti, that is a definition of a third world country. There's trash everywhere, no running water, no plumbing, right? So it is third world, and I noticed it was glaring that less than probably 20% of people had like legitimate shoes. There was bottles with rope tied on them just for some sort of foot protection. Meanwhile, they're walking and the ground's covered in trash, broken glass bottles, raw sewage. And so I just had like this like feeling in my heart, like, all right, I want to do something with shoes. My nickname since I was 13 is Super Shoe, like good driver or whatever. I was coined that and kind of stuck. A lot of people know me by Shoe. So I came back and was trying to look at some different ways to raise some shoes and to ship them down there. Kind of like small ideas. Well, a buddy of mine, it's like, have you ever heard of Samaritan's Feet? And I'm like, I kind of, because Steve Smith did some work with them, the Carolina Panthers. So mm-hmm. I've heard about them, but I never really knew their mission. A buddy of mine introduced me to Manny, who's the founder of Samaritan's Feet. And him and I, what thought was going to be a 20-minute conversation, turned to a 3-hour conversation. And everything that I had envisioned, they already had the infrastructure, the logistics, the whole deal. Like, they already, to that point where I got introduced to them, they've donated over 7 million pairs of shoes.
Wow.
And just in 2020, they've donated over, I think, 400,000 pairs of shoes. So their goal is 10 million. And whenever they get to 10 million, they're just going to keep doing more. But I felt, there was no need for me to try to do any of that groundwork. I'm just going to pour my time and resources into Samaritan's Feet because they align perfectly. So fast forward a couple months to July. It was a couple weeks before Watkins Glen. We didn't have a sponsor lined up for there. And I had legitimately a dream. Like, I had this dream of a Samaritan's Feet car. In the middle of the night, I wake up and I try to go back to bed. Like, all right, who's gonna pay for it? Can I get somebody to be on the quarter panels and put Samaritan's Feet on the hood? Like, how do you do it? And I just, it was like, God was like, nope, you're gonna ask to not get paid your salary this month and see if and Archie's gonna put it on the car. And I was like, I don't like that idea. That's
I could have heard that right. That must have been breaking up.
Like, I'm like looking around. There's like a radio going on or something. So I texted Archie, hey man, you up? And he's like, yeah. So I came downstairs, talked to him, ran by my ideas. Like, are you sure? And I'm like, no, but let's hang up before I change my mind.
Right.
And come to my senses. Well, you know, so he obviously, what I get paid a month isn't what it probably costs for him to run one race. So there's a give and take on both of our sides. And then, so we locked in Samaritan's Feet for Watkins Glen. We were going to figure out some ways to really get the fans involved with the race, more awareness for the cause, and try to put shoes on feet. So my wife and I were at dinner one night. She had the idea of whoever donates Samaritan's Feet, whether it's $1, $10, $1,000, $1,000,000, you'll get your name written on the car. We'll write it. Gold Sharpie, black car. It'll be great. I'm like, sure, that'll be, you know, if that raises 20 grand, that'd be a win. Right. So we announce it. NASCAR NBC picks it up, writes an article. And then it not necessarily went viral, but a lot of people started writing stories on it and started blowing up on social media. Names started pouring in. And I literally had to write the way it wasn't very efficient. So if somebody donated, I had to physically write their name down because it came in individual emails and I had to write every single name. So I wrote every person's name. There were 1,737 names that made it onto the car. And I wrote every single one of those names twice. Actually, maybe not every single one. My wife helped me write some of them. I probably at least wrote all 1,500 names twice. So we raised over 135 grand from the time we announced it to Sunday race time, which was unbelievable. You know, there's a story in the Bible where Jesus takes the two fish and five loaves and feeds 5,000. That's what I felt like it was for us. We just offer our little race car up, and next thing you know, it was taken away and provided a lot of shoes for a lot of people. And then we did it again at the Roval, raised a good amount of money there as well. So collectively, man, it was a humbling experience to see all the fans that were so excited to help out with that cause, trying to figure out some ways this year to get those guys incorporated. But it's a great charity, great cause. And, you know, there's not really a need for me to have a Corey LaJoy Foundation or a Super Shoes Fund, like, because I'm going to dump everything I've got into Samaritan's Feet because they already have the infrastructure. And really, they're doing things bigger and better than I could ever dream of. So anybody wants any information on them, samaritansfeet.org is the place to check it out.
That's what I was going to ask. Samaritansfeet.org, you can get the information, you can donate, you can do great things. Because of that selfless gesture you made, you were awarded the NMPA Spirit Award. I was very happy to hear that. I got to cover that race in Watkins Glen, and it's so wonderful. You know, you, like me, we live in a bubble. And for 20 years, that bubble was it, right? Good, bad, or indifferent, that was it. How we ran, pit decisions, damn lap time, tight, loose, that was my whole life. I've now stepped back to television, and while I get to cover that bubble, and I feel like I'm still vested in it, I get to see a little bit of what I call the real world. And it is wonderful when the real world spills over into that bubble. And that's what I think happened that day at Watkins Glen. The reason that story went viral is because it wasn't about financial raising to keep a car on the track. It wasn't about who was going to win or who was going to lose. It was a moment in time that you made the sacrifice and your owner made the sacrifice. And it was a wonderful story, and it was supported by a bunch of people. So it's you know, in my 6 years of doing TV, I have a bunch of great memories of Kyle Busch and Kyle Larson wrecking each other at Charlotte, or you know, Dale Jr. winning the first ever race I covered. But the non-competition stories, I think that one might lead the way as just something I was proud to cover, right? Proud to be a part of. It was a cool thing, and it was cool to do. We've talked a lot about racing. We heard your new man, Levi. I want to talk about 28, married in 2018, a son this year, So I know I had children about the same time I became a crew chief. And like I said, I didn't change many diapers. My wife is an absolute superstar. And it wasn't until, and you haven't got to experience this yet, but it wasn't until they were maybe 5 or 6 and I came home after a good run and a bad run. And guess what? They didn't care. They don't care that I won or I lost. So for you and the ups and downs of racing that exists for everyone, what has it meant to have a wife and now a family and that support staff that I'm guessing she doesn't care how you do on the racetrack, right? You're her husband regardless. And what's it like to share like everything you have going on with someone?
Well, the other element too is I've lived it because I was the kid,
right?
5, 6 years old with my old man coming home, right? And even to this day, I don't think any more or any less of my dad because he's a 2-time Busch Series champion. He's my dad. He's raised me. I appreciate my parent. I mean, I think everybody can say they appreciate their parents way more when they have a kid of their own because they know how much work's involved. Like there's like Randy sat there and held a bottle into my mouth and changed my diapers. Yeah. Like you wouldn't think he did,
right?
But he did. So, you know, I remember my dad coming home from, I remember watching him. He won Memphis, I think was maybe his last career Busch Series win, 2001. So maybe Jeff Green or somebody else got together, Jason Keller or somebody, and dad passed him coming to the white flag. And I remember I can vividly recall my mom jumping at least 5 feet off the ground. I thought her head was going to hit the ceiling. She was jumping so high, jumping. And that's just one of those memories I recall. Me and my brother sitting there like watching mom like she's an estranged person jumping up and down because dad won this race. And, you know, we're obviously excited because dad won the race. But we were excited for him just to come home because he's been gone for 3 days. And there were some weekends where he brought the trophy and set it on the kitchen table. And there are some weeks he didn't. It's not like we thought, oh, dad, you run 8th. Yep.
Right.
Do a better job. So when I come home on Sunday nights or Monday morning, usually when I get to see him, you know, when we broke another fuel pump, I think it's our 6th one we've had trouble with this year. This morning when I get to see him, that fuel, I could give 2 craps about that fuel pump,
right?
Like it doesn't matter. And I almost think, I don't know how you felt with this, Steve, but I think that if when you have a kid, even a wife, but a kid's another level of love, like unconditional love.
Yes.
It's hard to describe. I feel like it allows me to put more effort into my driving craft. Like there's a distinct difference between your personal life and your career now, where my entire life, personal and professional, was wrapped into one. I could never separate it. I could never turn the switch off. It was always tight, loose. Like how the hell do you find 3 more counts of downforce? Why, like, how do I maintain my track position better on a restart? And I'd be stewing on that on a Wednesday afternoon when I'd be watching film back and I'd be looking at SMT. Now, when I'm plugged in SMT and watching previous races and doing my notes, like, I'm doing my notes and I'm concentrating. And when I'm doing personal stuff, hanging out with the wife, going to dinner, changing Levi's diaper, I'm doing personal stuff. So it allows me to plug in and actually focus more in every individual area of my life.
Yeah, perspective helped me. I didn't realize, but stepping away from anything makes me better when I step back into it. I think it just is a recharger. And you mentioned family. So if my house caught on fire today after I got my children and my wife out, I would run back in, not for a single trophy, but I have a picture on the wall in my office of my son, me, and my dad at the dirt track when my son's racing. And that's it to me. Like, that's why my son's not going to be a race car driver professionally. He just loves to do it. My dad goes to the football games because he's a great granddad. But there's the picture of the 3 of us. And I'm like, you know, that's it. That's what I was taught to do. And now he's teaching it to my son. So to your point, it's this moment that I would never change. So I have a lot to talk about still. I want to get into more current state of the sports stuff. We're going to have some conversation. I want to ask you about your own podcast, but real quick, kind of in the middle, we do some quick hitters with every guest. So these are questions. I don't want a lot of thought to them. I just want a good, honest answer. I got 6 of them right here. So this is quick hitters with Corey LaJoy. All right. First one, the most used app on your phone.
Probably Instagram.
Instagram, okay. I was going to say mine's Twitter. So Instagram, I like to honestly. Are you a fly or a road trip guy?
Man, I'll tell you. And I know these are quick hitters, but I'm gonna
yeah, go ahead. About this second.
There are certain races a year where I have the option to fly to that I'll choose to drive to, like Daytona, the Daytona 500. I don't care if I'm making $30 million. I am driving to Daytona for the first race. It's something about that drive.
Yes, in Brunswick, Georgia, Bite to Eat in Jacksonville. I know the drive, man. I love everything about it.
You cannot fly to – I personally. Anybody else that wants to jump in their jet Sunday afternoon and ride down there last minute, good on you. But as long as I'm driving – or as long as I'm in the sport, I am driving to the Daytona 500. I'm driving to Bristol. I'm driving to Martinsville. I'm driving to Darlington. Even if I have the choice to fly, there's just some that you gotta charge up a little bit.
I like that. I like that. I totally, completely understand. All right, how about a go-to drink?
Like alcoholic or
yeah, like when you go out to the bar, what you go to? Are you a beer guy? You get a cocktail? What do you get?
I'm a whiskey guy.
Brown liquor guy. Oof, me and you can't. That brown liquor stuff is no good. I stay away from it completely. All right, you're in pretty good shape. This question for me is neither. I'll ask the question for you: weights or cardio?
You gotta have balance. You gotta have a little bit of mixed both.
All right.
I'll say mountain biking is probably so. If you call mountain biking cardio, you call it cardio.
Yeah, oh, that's cardio for sure. Your biggest pet peeve.
Oh, man. I guess people going slow in the fast lane or people don't put their shopping carts away at the grocery store.
Shopping carts is one on me. Mine is very simple. It's punctual. Like, we're leaving at 7. You don't got to be there at 6:45, but, damn, don't come at 7:05. Like, that's 7 nice. O'clock is drop dead time. That's Ray Not Abraham bad. Instituted it in me. If you are a 7:01, your ass is walking.
Yeah, and I'm bad about that. That's probably not one of my fortes is being punctual. I appreciate it, but – Now, 80% of the time, I'm showing up right at 7, and I don't build in enough buffer to where if stuff doesn't go as planned, I can't get there on
time. That just proves to me that you're meant to be a race car driver. That's a habit of all race car drivers. Right, I'm going to go with worst habit, then. That's my last one, the sixth question. What's your worst habit?
Probably disorganization. Okay. I'm bad about double booking things or, like, perfect case in point, right? We had to move this thing because I forgot I had something going on. So, appreciate the flexibility.
Oh, I love it. All right, there you go. Quick hitters with Corey LaJoy. So, Corey, we've talked a lot about your career, how you've got here, the family you've created, everything about it. You know, so there's something that I've always found endearing about you, and that is you have what I like to label is you have this kind of superstar confidence without a superstar resume. And what I mean by this is whether it's on social media or in person, it's not rude. It's not over the top. But you have the swagger to hand a letter to Mr. Hendrick that says, hey, I should drive the 48. You have the swagger to disagree with Denny Hamlin and have a good, heated conversation, which I know you say, hey, could have done it different. We're not into the details. The point is you have the swagger to kind of follow up and not what I would say quivered or some of these superstars. Denny Hamlin's resume is impressive. Mr. Hendrick's Mr. H, right? He's the guy. Why is that? What gives you this confidence to be your own person? That's what I label it. You have confidence to be your own man.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of that has to do with who I was raised around, right? It wasn't just Randy LaJoy and his unique tactics of raising a kid, let alone to be a race car driver, just a human being in general. But it's been just learning from guys like Jimmy, from Harvick, from guys like Tim Fedewa, that I've been around since I was a little kid. And I've also seen the other side of it where, you know, guys don't have confidence in themselves. And if, you know, the age-old saying is if you don't believe in yourself, there's nothing truer in our sport of NASCAR. If you don't believe in your sport, there's not another person in the world that's going to believe in you because there's so much, you know, ebbs and flows by the driver's morale. You know, you got to have confidence in your abilities to do inside the race car as well as what you believe in outside the race car. And, you know, competitively, I do believe that in the right situation with the right people, I do believe I can win cup races and compete for championships. Would it be a little bit of a learning curve to figure out that side of the garage?
Right.
Absolutely. But I personally believe, I don't know the difference yet, but I think it's equally, if not a little bit harder, to learn the back end of the garage and how the etiquette and how to scratch and claw your way to stay in here, because there's always three or four more guys with more money than you wanting to buy your seat out. So the opportunities to stay in the garage the last 3 or 4 years, you know, I think that's making a lot of persistence, you know, and then the driving stuff is just the stuff that I've been doing since I've been 4 years old. You know, and I've got trophies to go down there and look if I, you know, there's many times I've come home something like, what in the hell am I doing? Like, do I even know what I'm doing? Mm-hmm. And, you know, I don't go down there and like turn the lights on and be like, oh yeah, I do know what I'm doing. But there's moments where I can recall being in, you know, like you get this out of body experience almost of where like that car, you were driving that car to its fastest capabilities. And the top 20 guys in our sport are driving their cars to the fastest of its capabilities. But with the disparity between the good cars and the first place car and the 30th place car, you're handicapped in a lot of ways. And, you know, I think that there are some guys, it's easy to get your confidence beat down, and you have to figure out ways to keep that confidence built. And why wouldn't I try to, you know, is it unrealistic to think that some factors couldn't work out in my favor and Rick takes the chance on a guy like myself, or he took the chance on Alex Bowman, worked out pretty good for Alex, you know, Bob Levine took the chance on Matt DiBenedetto, then Wood Brothers took a chance on him. Now he's doing pretty sporty as well. Yep. So, you know, on paper, I put together better careers than those guys have in the small opportunities that I've had. So if we're looking at facts, I can back the facts up and the stats on the paper. And when it comes to confidence off the track and how I can speak on the sport, how I can market myself on social media, you know, I feel like I can bring a lot of value to whatever team's looking.
Hey, listen, and you're absolutely right. I was a 26-year-old kid with Jeff Gordon, said, you're going to be the guy. And I was like, man, I think you're crazy. But I'm excited for the opportunity. I'm only here talking to you today because, you know, Jeff Gordon and Rick Hendrick thought a 26-year-old could pull this deal off. And, I've said this, and I'll go on record to say it again, that you know, I was a very good crew chief for Dale Jr., and Jeff Gordon didn't get my best years because I didn't know what I didn't know, right? But he gave me a shot, and I'll always be grateful for that. You know, so this is an opportunity – we talk about the state of the sport all the time in TV, and we hear from all the big stars that are up there with the big funded teams, and we hear the big funded owners. But I personally have never been in your shoes. I've been dumb lucky, right? I work for Rick Hendrick, and I cover sports for NBC. I've never been on one of those teams trying to grind out week in and week out. So I want to have this state of the sport conversation with you. I'm going to start with this, what I'm calling forced lessons of COVID. So I'm going to look at COVID as a positive, right? There's so many awful things we could look at. So let's look at something that's come out of it. I see shorter weekends. I see no practice. I see no qualifyings. I'm not sure I like zero practice. But damn, if we go back to 3 hours of practice, Corey, I'm going to lose my brain. Like, we don't need 3 hours in my mind. For a small team, though, where do you stand on these, you know, modified schedules?
Yeah, so – yeah, to your point, I feel like NASCAR had to be very flexible, and in that, it also got rid of some of the things that they were probably considered necessities, because it was a non-starter for NASCAR to start a race without practice ever. Oh, I mean, it was we're gonna scrap qualifying and we're gonna fit in a 30-minute practice. Like, we have to practice now with simulation, seven post, CFD, all this stuff. Like, we're a quarter inch track bar, 25 pounds of left rear spring, maybe, and some Packer shim away from being dialed in. So,
right,
you know, the age old moniker of a Friday practice, qualifying practice, then you line up to qualify, you need a happy hour. Like, I think that anything above a hot lap session of sorts.
Yeah, right.
A very minimal, very small time where you get one set of tires to make some tape adjustments for your radiator, for a Packer shim, maybe a sway bar change if you're really feeling pretty crazy. But, you know, these engineers are so smart and they have previous notebooks and all that. I don't think you need some sort of practice, because you hate to determine a champion with whoever can plug in the best simulation numbers and spit it out that day, right? Where, you know, and I think NASCAR knows that, but out of the state of our world right now, especially the country, you know, I think less interaction, less time at the racetrack, less people to have to be at the racetrack. You know, I think they're going to keep it as small as possible now, but yeah, they also have to look ahead at 2022 when that new car, you can't rifle off those cars with no practice because it's completely different than what we're used to. So there's lots of factors that play in, but generally speaking, we're professional drivers and professional teams that put out a professional effort. So we should be good to go.
So I completely agree. I think one size does not fit all, right? Maybe the second time to a track, we need less practice than the first time. And I think that's the key is this is not a black and white. You're not either in or out for practice. That's not what we're saying. There's a curve to it. I tell everyone the story. So my son and I, we had this great idea a couple of years ago. We're going to tow our stuff up to Knoxville, Iowa. The Knoxville Nationals are going along. We're going to run the dirt, like little mini outlaw, yeah, East Coast Nationals. And we roll into this racetrack and our stuff's pretty nice. You know, we're ready to go. My kid's 14. And I'm like, 2-day show? All right, what do we get, like 5 or 6 hot lap sessions? And they're like, no, you get one. I'm like, one, huh? Never been here before yet. Yep. 4 laps. That's what a 14-year-old got before he dropped off for the dual heat races. And then, like, 4 laps. The first two were, oh, I'm still in fourth gear. Let me find fifth. And then yeah, the other 2 laps were really the thing. And we drew pole for the heat. And I'm like, well, this is either going to go good or bad. To your point, it doesn't have to be quite that dramatic. But these people that – think the world can't spin because we don't have practice. I'm like, man, let's fire them off. So I think we all agree that some is needed, not as much as we had, maybe not cold turkey. You brought up the car. A lot of conversation about the car. I applaud NASCAR delaying it a year. I think we all had to delay everything a year. This is some crazy times, right? But talk about where that car, so for the people listening, don't know what I'm talking about, in the 80s, you bought a car from a couple different people, and you bolted it together, and you went and raced. Yeah. Then for the last 25 years, these big owners have got these car-building companies. My dad was one of them. He got hired in to build these cars, and they're trick. Make no mistake about it. They are trick. NASCAR said, yeah, I don't think we need all that. We're going to take it back to where everybody buys all the parts and pieces again. That's the simplest way I know how to explain it. Where do you, in the size team you race for, do you look at the new car as something scary, as an opportunity? You think it's going to level the playing field? What's your gut feeling about this car coming?
Well, the thought of it, the premise of that they're trying to achieve, I like the thought of it. At the end of the day, the cream will still rise to the top. Guys, that they're fit and finish, their bodies move a little bit more, the suspension has compliance in the areas that needs that compliance.
And I want to say that matters to me. The crew chief, right? I want to be important, right? I still want to be able to put my little swing on it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that – but the NASCAR needs to start getting – NASCAR needs to rein it in a little bit, because when you're asking Toyota or any of these OEMs, Ford, Chevrolet, to invest tens of millions of dollars into development, into – parts and pieces that aren't relative to what they're putting in their cars on the street, there's eventually comes a point where they, Edsel Ford wakes up like, what are we doing here? Right. So you have to take the money that the sponsors are, if Body Armor, for example, since it's right here, we're into, like they sell sports drinks, right? If they're giving Penske a lot of money, they're asking Penske where they're spending their money. Can they sell more Body Armor by spending their money on left rear truck arm development or activation out in the fan zone? Because that's, I mean, all the money, all the sponsorship money that's in take is into development, trying to make the race cars go fast, because at the end of the day, that's what we try to do. So if we can rein the cost of the car and actually cost the development down, which NASCAR is trying to do with this new car, of course, it's going to give better return for the sponsors, better return for the OEMs, and it actually might entice some more OEMs with sport, which I think is a really important factor as well. So, you know, the small teams, at the end of the day, they're still going to, you know, have less parts to work with. You know, I think for me, I hope NASCAR can look at the engine model. I feel like that's a little bit out of control right now, because our program's on a B engine type program because it's just cheaper. You know, so, and A, obviously, if you pay double the price for something, you'd want double the performance. And that's the barrier that pretty much separates us from getting up in the mix consistently. So, you know, the smaller teams are always going to figure out ways to make it economical for the amount of money and the purse money they can round up. And, you know, I think that it can close the gap, though, from the very strongly funded teams from the OEMs to the teams like GoFast, because the essence of racing is to be able to go to the Ford dealership, grab a Ford Mustang, weld a cage in it, and you go to the racetrack. We got away from that a long time ago.
Yeah, I mean, I think there, like anything, there's going to be bumps along the way, but just because it's challenging or just because there's setbacks doesn't mean it's not the right way to go. I've had a lot of great setups that if I quit halfway through developing the setup, I would have never got on the track. I actually just read a story today, and I remember this test. We took the famed T-Rex car to about four tests, and the thing couldn't run out of its own way. And then one day we finally, Ray kind of brainstormed the setup up, and we finally got the front end sealed up, and it was the best thing ever. I'm like, that was one set of tires away from going into the junkyard. People have no idea. Like, it was one set of Goodyear Eagles away from no longer seeing the racetrack. So, you know, you don't know how close you could be to something great, right?
Imagine that. And I'd be remiss if I didn't bring up, I use it all the time. Not even talking to you, just in general, especially when people are talking about practice. There, you know, Dale Jr. says it all the time too. He'll go to Dale Jr., go to you. Stevie, why do we always start the race where we ended up? We change sway bars and springs and move the track bar, and we always start the race right where we started practice. And you say,
yeah, I tell them all the time. I said, you know, we just didn't come with them a guess. We worked weeks on what we unloaded with what we thought was best. You know, like it was a lot of effort put into that. We just didn't swing it together on a Friday morning.
Right, you all didn't get time to the track that day, but I think, well, let's put that 1200 in the right rear and ship.
That's just, yeah. I mean, yeah. Guys be nuts.
Yeah, you also they didn't line up and ask Rick Hendrick to spend millions of dollars on a 7-post rig and sit there watching the car shake around for hours on end to just come off the hip and try to come up with a setup.
I tell people all the time, if they really knew what crew chiefs did, they would think it's the boringest job in the world. You watch cars shaking a room. You watch cars with air blown on them, but you can't see the air is moving. I was like, you look at a bunch of squiggly lines on a computer. That's pretty fascinating stuff. Let me tell you, if it wasn't for 4 hours on Sunday, it would be perhaps the most thankless job in the world. But the fact that you get to go out and play chess against 39 other crew chiefs is an absolute dream. I won't lie. I love crew chiefing, I love TV, but that's the Freudian slip. I don't there's not a race that green flags that I don't think, man, this would be fun just to sit down there one more time and try to figure out, you know, a way to outsmart everybody else. Corey, listen, man, I appreciate your time. You mentioned a bunch of names. I want to cover again. You get SamaritanSpeed.org if somebody wants to sponsor or understand and learn about a great situation. Give me your partners again.
Yeah, so Schluter Systems been with me for the last couple of years. They're a great partner for anything. If you want to redo your bathroom or kitchen, look at Schluter System products. They'll hook you up. Keen Parts, they're a great supporter of GoFast. We've got Built Bar is another company that came on board this year. It's a protein bar company. So that's been a lot of fun to work with there. So trying to get some more every day and try to put gas in that thing, keep it going.
Hey, man, listen, I get to cover you from the TV booth, and I would say if I was an owner of a race team, I'd give you a shot. What I see is a guy that understands what he has, tries to outperform what he has, when he's given an opportunity. I know this sounds silly to people listening. I look at when you led Martinsville, right? They put you up there in an opportunity to make a mistake or make a highlight reel. You do nothing of the sort. You run your lane. You run your speed. You do the best for your race car. I think you do a great job, man. I appreciate your time today. As always, you have a podcast, Sunday Money.
So if anybody Sunday Money.
It's a weekly podcast. Corey LaJoy. This has been another episode of Letard on Location. Listen, subscribe, rate, tell us how we're doing. This podcast is available anywhere you get your podcasts. Thank you.
Dietz and Watson's been making meats and cheeses the right way since forever. What's that mean? It means never cutting corners, ever. It means cooking, not processing. It means our Virginia brand ham that's cooked to perfection, then twice baked to layer the flavors. It takes more time, but you can taste the difference. We come to work every day to do it the right way, even if it's the hard way. Because if it's not right for us, it's not right for you. Dietz and Watson, it's a family thing since 1939.